So just to like review, because I want to just try to capture some of what we came away with it in the last week before we jump into this week, because this is the real some of the meat of Sefer Shmuel, right? The request for a king. And we didn't even really get up to the request for a king at all last week, because we spent most of our time some talking about Shmuel's age and a comment of Abarbanel, but a lot of it focusing on the Navi's enigmatic description of the sin of Shmuel's sons, right? And I think that there were a couple of main takeaways to get from that, which I really just want to have, nailed down in our minds as we go forward in our learning of the Sefer. Number one was just the general phenomenon of how Chazal and the Mefarshim and the Navi discuss when we have sins by prominent figures in Sefer Shmuel. And this is the second time we've had it. The first was the sons of Eli. The second is the sons of Shmuel. And all of this is really, giving us, preparing us and giving us, some tools for the shadow that just looms over all of Sefer Shmuel, which we're not going to get to in a long time, but it's never too early to start thinking about it, which is the sin of David and Bathsheba, right? So already at this stage, at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, introduces us to two different situations, right? Of sins, the sin of this of the sons of Eli, the sin of the sons of Shmuel. And so interestingly, the Gemara, that key Gemara in Shabbos, which says that the sons of Eli didn't sin, and then goes through all the different views about how they did sin. And then the sons of Shmuel didn't sin, and then goes through all the views of how they did sin. But we came away from that with really two different angles when it came to the sons of Eli. So Rashi jumped in and Rashi said, I'll quote you the Gemara, but read the Pasuk, kimashma'o, right? That sometimes, the pshat really is more in line with reading it, the sin as was described in the Navi. And it's important to get the different perspectives. On the other hand, we got a very different perspective last week with the sons of Shmuel, where a literal read of the pasuk that they were literally taking bribes and throwing court cases because they were taking bribes was just extremely difficult to fit in with the broader framework of Sefer Shmuel. The fact that Hashem is not criticizing Shmuel at all, the fact that we contrast the outcome of Bnei Eli, which the house is met with total destruction, with the outcome of Sefer Shmuel, of Shmuel and his family, which is the exact opposite. We see Shmuel's grandson still running the singing in the Beis HaMikdash, right? And I was just pointing to the fact that we have times where the Navi seems to present sins in a more severe manner than they actually may have been. We had a whole range of views as to what those were. And what was so interesting was that a couple of the opinions of the Gemara went out of their way to even more strongly accentuate the link that's already, in the Navi itself, between the sons of Shmuel and the sons of Eli. You come away from this and you can't help but think of the sons of Eli when thinking of the sons of Shmuel. The older father, the sons who are not following in the father's way, right? So even though we may not, it may be true that, the Mefarshim are saying for the most part, do not compare the sin of the sons of Shmuel to the sons of Eli in the sense of how bad actually was it, we can't help but notice that the Navi wants us to be, and Chazal want us to be thinking of Bnei Eli when thinking of Bnei Shmuel. And I think that the reason for that is because as we launch into the question of the kingship, so even before the discussion begins, so the Navi just sets up the perfect conundrum for us, right? What is the Jewish model of leadership supposed to be? Well, we're about to be introduced to the dynastic royal model. And the alternative is what we've had until now, which we could, call the individual charismatic leader model, right? The shofet. And Shmuel's going to, blast. He's going to spend a long time talking about how bad the melucha is. And we'll, as we learn, say, for Shmuel, we'll see, Shaul, does not give kingship a good rap. Even David, the Navi, the Oppid does not shy away from David's flaws. If anything, it seems to accentuate them dramatically. We think about the dynastic model. Well, we've already been introduced to two situations where that doesn't work. The sons of Eli, the sons of Shmuel, no good, right? David's sons are not going to, in Sefer Shmuel, David's sons are not going to live up to what we would hope for, right? So the dynastic model, it's had problems in the past, it's going to have problems in the future. But what's your alternative? If your alternative is, you know, the individual leader, well, we're going to see here, even Shmuel, right, the greatest of the great, who's going to choose your leaders? You couldn't hope for somebody better than Shmuel to be deciding who the next leader should be. And yet again and again, Shmuel also is going to fail in deciding, if we had to pick from scratch, who the best leader should be. First he picks his sons, no good. Then he's going to be very into Shaul, not going to work. He's going to see David's family, and he's going to be excited about all the other brothers, not going to work either. So either model of leadership we have, if we look to political leadership as the panacea for our problems, you know, if we can just figure out the right mode of government, the right mode of selecting a leader, already we come into the whole discussion realizing that that's not going to work. Because if you go with dynasty, that's had its problems and it's going to have its problems. And if you go with Shmuel choosing the leader, oh, that's had its problems, it's going to have its problems again. And bringing the sons of Shmuel in is the perfect case where it's both, right? You want dynastic? They didn't follow their father's way once again. You want Shmuel choosing the leader? That doesn't work. That doesn't work either. So, you know, we begin the Parshas HaMelech just realizing either way we go, we're not going to have a political solution. And at the end of the Parshas HaMelech, when we get to the end of Perek Yud-Beis, we'll see that's going to be Shmuel's exact message to Bnei Yisrael when he leaves. He's going to sign off by telling them, you know, you have the king you want. You wanted him to save you. I think it's a bad idea. But at the end of the day, whether you're led by a shofet or whether you're led by a melech, ultimately what's going to matter is not the political model you have, but the behavior of the people. So it's already, you know, the problem that's being set up in the beginning is kind of telegraphing Shmuel's message at the end. I think that's just very important as a mindset for us to have as we begin looking at, you know, the absolutely critical paragraph. So now I'll load up the screen share. You know, this week we'll really drill into the demand for a king. So, right, so the Navi describes, and we read a couple of these psukim last week, we didn't really delve into them carefully. So the Navi tells us, Pasuk Daled, all of the Ziknei Yisrael, right, the prominent leaders of Bnei Yisrael, let's remember that, right, it's the, you know, political chieftains, maybe the Nesiim. So they come to Shmuel, and they tell him, we want a king, right, you've gotten old. Wonder how Shmuel took that, says your sons have not followed in your path. Now we want a king to judge us like all of the other nations. Right? And that's a very provocative couple of words. Shmuel is very upset. Shmuel davens to Hashem. And then we saw Radak last week, but we should keep this in mind, right? Because it's a very important point. Radak says that Shmuel's davening here is yet another example of a parallel between Shmuel and Moshe Rabbeinu, right? Where you have a problem, well, let's confer with Hashem and see what the solution should be. Moshe does that all the time, Lachamish. And Shmuel, here's another example of that, right? The people want a king. Shmuel turns to Hashem and says, let's get together, figure out what to do, right? So, you know, with that, so Shmuel now turns to Hashem. Hashem answers, and now they're going to have a discussion. And what we'll do, I think the shir, we're basically going to break up into 2.5 parts. The first part, we'll do an overview of what the Tanakh's view of kingship seems to be. The second half of this year, we'll delve into Shmuel's message to the people about what their king is actually going to look like. And then hopefully we'll have time for a couple of closing thoughts at the end. So when Hashem responds to Shmuel, he is absolutely crystal clear that, you know, he's not a fan of this request. It's not that they've rejected you, it's that they've rejected me from ruling over them, right? You know, and Hashem says, you know, I look back from the beginning of Yetzias Mitzrayim until now, you know, and they've been the same from then till now. Right? They're just doing it to you as well. And yet Hashem says, Pasuk Tes, despite the fact that I strongly disapprove of the request, just like Shmuel does, he says, nevertheless, Shma B'Kolam. It's going to be a bit of a theme. Shma B'Kolam is going to be a theme in this parak. Listen to their voice, right? But tell them what the Mishpat HaMelech is. So the clear implication from these couple of psukim is that Hashem is not a fan of the request for a king. Right now, how, you know, and yet he gives them one, right? And yet he gives them one. So that ambiguity, right? That kind of mixed messaging about kingship, right? Is it good? Is it bad? We're upset about the request, but we're obeying the request. So that it runs through all the Mefarshim and really in the Chumash itself. It's inherent in the Chumash itself. This could be, you know, a whole thing. The Monday night, you know, shiur that I've been doing, we talked about some of this a little bit greater length. But for the purposes of what we're, you know, focusing, keeping our learning on Sefer Shmuel, I just want to hit like a couple of the quick hit highlights to show that, right? So the first, you look at Sefer Dvarim, we'll look at Sefer Bereishis. Sefer Dvarim, the request for a king. So on the one hand, Pasuk Yudalid, it sounds very negative. The Torah says, "V'amarta asima alai melech kechol hagayim asher sigibosai." You're going to say, "I want a king like all of the nations who are around me." That sounds terrible. Sefer Devarim is all about Moshe telling Bnei Yisrael, "You're going to go into the land of Eretz Canaan, and you're going to want to look just like the other nations, and you're going to want to worship like the other nations. You're going to want to have a Asherot and a Mizbecha like the other nations." Sounds like just of a piece with this. It sounds like, you know, the setting up of a king is being compared to Avodah Zarah. I'm going to want to have a king like they all do, just like Moshe Rabbeinu has been talking about. You're going to have gods like they all do. In fact, the Ramban says that this pasuk is a prophetic anticipation of what's going to happen in Shmuel, right? Because this is basically exactly what the people are going to say. Sounds extremely negative. And yet, you get to pasuk Tesvav, and all of a sudden, Torah says, Sum tasim alach ha-melech. You shall surely place a king upon yourself. And this is counted as one of the Taryag mitzvos, the mitzvah of putting in a king. We'll look at the Gemara about this a little bit later on. But you get a total swing, right? Not just you can have a king, but you shall surely make for yourself a king. Sum tasim alach ha-melech asher yivchar Hashem lokach labo. And he's going to get a divine endorsement, right? So pasuk yudalek, pasuk tesvav, you get completely mixed messages about what, you know, how approving or disapproving are we of the idea of a melech. Even if we go back to Sefer Bereishis, so we have the exact same phenomenon. I should have printed this differently. Whatever it is, it is. You go to the parsha of the four kings and the five kings. It's the first time the Torah really introduces the idea of kings, right? Parshas Bereishis, Parshas Nalach, we don't really see Malachim. There's like one word where the Torah refers to Nimrod, but we're really introduced to the idea of Malchus for the first time in Parshas Lech Lecha, the battle of the four kings and the five kings. And you see how the Torah, I just highlighted the words over and over again, the Chumash like goes out of its way. You know, you have kings everywhere. Melech, 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 melech. The word is used again and again and again and again and again in the whole parasha. In the four kings, in the five kings, you have Malki Tzedek, Melech Yerushalayim, who's coming, you know, out of the woodwork. You just have kings everywhere. And for the most part, the kings are a disaster. What's being associated with Malchus? Melchama, right? War. Melchama is associated with Malchus. You have war with kingship. You have massacres, you have starvation, you have taking the people's food, killing the people, and invading, and building empires, and violence, and everything, right? Not a pretty picture you get of the Battle of the Four Kings and the Five Kings. Sidon makes its first appearance in this parsha. And contrasted with all of this is Avraham Avinu's message at the end, right? After dealing with all these kings, he's fighting kings, he's debating kings, he's taking food from kings. So what's Avraham's message to all of them, right? Is that you all represent your petty little states or empires or whatever, and you think you're all kings, but who does Avraham stand for? Harimosi adi al Hashem kel elyon konei shamayim ba'aretz, right? Rebbeinu Shalom, who is the master of everything. So you have all of these king, 25 times in one parakeet of kings. They're killing and fighting and looting and everything. Contrasted with, you know, who Avraham Avinu is standing for. Right? And he's standing for Hashem, Kel Elyon Konei Shamayim Ba'aretz. He's totally apart from everyone, right? He may have to fight the battles, but he's not on the side of the Four Kings. He's not on the side of Melech Sodom, right? He's not going to take any of the booty from the battle. He's remaining disconnected from the entire project. This whole world of kings is not the world of Abraham. You come out of Parshas Lech Lecha, right? The Parsha where kingship, the Torah first puts it on our in our minds, with A, thinking kings are terrible. B, Avraham Avinu is completely disconnected from this entire project. And yet, at the same time, in Sefer Bereishis itself, we have Hashem promising Avraham and Yaakov, when their names are changed and they're transforming from individuals to national figures, from Avram to Avraham, and from Yaakov to Yisrael. And Hashem promises both of them that they are going to sire kings. Hashem tells Abraham, Melachim mimcha yetzeyu. He tells Yaakov, Melachim mechalatecha yetzeyu. Clearly, kingship here is being thought of positively. And it's part of the bracha that Abraham and Yaakov are getting, is that among their descendants will be kings. So we have Sefer Dvarim, where we have back-to-back psukim that are giving us mixed messages about how we think of the Melach. We have Bereishis, Sefer Bereishis, which is also giving us very mixed messages of how to think about a Melech. The Navi Hosea, a couple of hundred years later after Shmuel, towards the end of the time of the 10 tribes, things are greatest before the fall. That towards the end of the 10 tribes, during the rule of the Yeravam, the second Yeravam, things are going great. The Aramean Empire is collapsing, who was their major enemy. So they're expanding, they're rich, everything is wonderful. Of course, the reason why everything is wonderful is because the empire of Ashur is growing and growing and growing. So it's destroying all of the enemies of the 10 tribes, right? So for a little bit of time, things are great because, 10 tribes are saying all our enemies are gone. We can live it up. And the Nevi'im are saying, it's good for now, but, Ashur is going to continue to grow and he's going to destroy you as well. But so you have the Navi Hosea who's spending the whole time blasting the 10 tribes at this period of time where they see things as being amazing. They're having a great time, but it's about to all go down the tubes. And Hosea seems to look back at our time in history with Shmuel, right? And he says, I gave you a king. You said, I gave you a king. You said, go to your king. Go to your king and he'll save you, the king that you wanted. And Hashem says, Eten lacha melech ba'api. I gave you a king in my anger. That's what you wanted. That's what you're getting. And then Hashem says, turn to your king and have him save you from the things that are coming down the road. Clearly seems to keep up that negative attitude. You have Midrashim and Devarim Rabbah. We're not going to look at all of them inside, but they're incredible anti-kingship Midrashim in Devarim Rabbah. One Midrash says, Hashem wanted us to be free in the desert and Yirmiyahu, and instead we wanted a king. Yirmiyahu there is talking about Avodah Zarah, so the Medrash says that really it's also talking about the request for a king. Medrash continues in the second paragraph. It says, never put your faith in man instead of the Ribono Sholem, and a prime example for that was the request for a king. And the last piece in the Medrash over here, which says, and we'll come back to the end of it, at the end of the shiur, but it says, you wanted a king, I gave you one. And we look at the record of kingship, it was a disaster. Shaul loses his battles, right? Bnei Yisrael asked for a king because they want someone to fight for them. Well, Shaul's going to die in battle at the end of Shmuel, right? Achav, disaster, causes drought. Tzidkiyahu, disaster, causes the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash and the exile from Yerushalayim. Says the Medrash, even David, the best of the kings, Nasan Magefa, he counts the people, he has a census at the end of Sefer Shmuel, and it leads to a plague. So the Medrash even includes David HaMelech and says, we look at the history of kingship and it did not get us where we wanted to go, right? Royalty creating a centralized royal government was not a panacea. It didn't work to solve the problems that we wanted it to solve. Okay, right? Hosea was upset. On the other hand, you have this really, really interesting debate between the Sefer Achinuch and the Abarbanel. Really interesting. Sefer Achinuch, basically, it's not what Yashi says, but we could look at all the evidence so far and say there are mixed messages about kings. Why? Because you have kings who are good, you have kings who are bad, right? You can have David, or you could have Tzidkiyahu, you could have Shlomo, you could have Asaph. Well, writes the Sefer Achina, and he says, and this is on the mitzvah, there's a mitzvah not to curse a Nasi, right? Not to curse a leader, whoever exactly that may be. And the Sefer Achina comments on this, and he says, we need leadership. He says, you could have a good king, you could have a bad king. But he says, Tzrichin lekabel das echad mehem im tov im ra. He says, bad kings, as bad as they are, and for sure it's bad, it's better than the anarchy we had in Sefer Shoftim, right? Sefer Shoftim, that was rock bottom when we had civil war and Pilagash Begiva and Bnei Yisrael were being compared outright to Sodom and we had genocide of Shevet Binyamin. Sefer Chinuch says, I can survey all the evidence and I can 100% acknowledge, right, what we that Medrash did a minute ago. Achav and Tzidkiyahu and Shaul, plenty of lowlights in the history of Jewish kingship. He says the bottom line is, you know, very realist perspective is that it's better than nothing, right? A bad centralized authority is better than nothing. That's one perspective. And then so interesting is to juxtapose that with the Abarbanel. Abarbanel, who's, you know, often quoted as the leader of the anti-monarchy camp, and for good reason, because Abarbanel spends his whole career, you know, serving different kings in Portugal and Spain and Italy, and every, you know, it keeps that from five or six times, he gets expelled or the king gets expelled and he has to start from scratch again. So, and then he ends his life living in Venice. So Abarbanel, who saw up close and personal all the ugliness of kings, you know, in their worst fashion. You know, he saw the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492, and that just put it on the list of all the crimes and depredations he saw from kings. So the Abarbanel says, you know, look, you think the advantage of a king is that at least he'll impose some authority. They'll say, I don't know. He says, look at the world where countries are run by royalty. Look at all the disgusting, you know, the idolatry, all the nasty stuff. And he says, you know, they all do whatever they want to do. That's the refrain from the end of Sefer Shoftim. So you've changed in the anarchy of the people for the anarchy of the arbitrary will of some you know, total king. Abarbanel says, hasn't gotten us very far, right? What, so now instead of, you know, Yishai Sharbenav Yaseh was bad, right? Sefer Shoftim was bad. But us living at the whim of whatever, you know, Ferdinand and Isabella feel like when they wake up in the morning, that doesn't help us out anymore, right? So it's almost like we're challenging the basic of the basic point. So you have, you know, just such a range of views, such a range. The bottom line, right? Let's, you know, probably let's say, you know, if we have to like come away with the closest to the pshat in our local piece of Sefer Shmuel, probably we focus on the view of the Rambam and the view of the Ram. The Rambam, right over here. So the Rambam counts one of the mitzvos to establish a king. The Rambam asks, why is it so obvious that they did that Hashem was upset with the request for a king in Sefer Shmuel? He says, because the reason they asked for a king was the wrong way, right? Lefisha sha'alu b'ta'aromes. The reason why they wanted a king was not to fulfill the mitzvah, it was not for more lofty ambitions to create a functioning, centralized, you know, well-organized society with peace and justice and efficiency. No, they wanted a king because they were disgusted with Shmuel, right? So Rambam is suggesting a king could be a positive institution when it's being set up for the right reasons. You know, but here it was the wrong way, it was the wrong time. The Ran, he has an amazing analysis of Sefer Shmuel, right, Rabbeinu Nissim, towards the end of the time of the Jews in Spain. He focuses on, scroll up for a second, to what the Jews actually ask Shmuel for. What do they say? They don't just say we want a king, they say we want a king to judge us like all other nations. So the Ran argues that the reason why they wanted a king was because they wanted to abandon the judicial system of the Sanhedrin, which you require witnesses and warnings, and there are all sorts of checks and balances, and it's not an efficient way to obtain justice, but that's the ideal system the Torah sets up. And the Ran says instead they wanted to embrace the alternative model, which is having a king judging, and a king just very quickly and efficiently deciding, looks like someone's a murderer, we're going to take him out. Looks like someone's a criminal, we're going to take him out. The Ran says they were going too far in pursuing a different, you know, judicial system. But either way, what, you know, these perspectives are all coming down to is saying, depending on how it's set up, the idea of Malchus could be positive, could be negative. The reason why I'm suggesting that that's the shot here in Sefer Shmuel is because that very nicely explains the miracle at the end of the whole story. The end of the whole story, Shmuel is going to gather everyone together for his retirement speech, right? And what is he going to do? He's going to tell them, it is in the middle of the summer, but I'm going to call out to Hashem and he is going to bring a thunderstorm, right? And there is a thunderstorm in the middle of the summer and the people panic. And you could ask, why do they panic to such a degree? It's, you know, okay, I get it. We don't have rain in Israel in the summer. But to such a degree that the pasuk says, Vayira kol ha'am me'ud es Hashem ve'eshmuel, the people are terrified and they immediately regret what they did. And they daven, we don't want to die. You know, undo we did, take away the king, etc. There's clearly some very profound message that's happening here. And the pshat is that Shmuel bringing rain in the summer is the perfect analogy for the idea of a king being requested for the wrong reasons. Because rain in and of itself can be beneficial, right? What's the message of Shmuel bringing rain in the summer? The summer when there's not supposed to be rain, when it's a time of harvest, when you want to be out in the fields and the grain is supposed to dry. That is a scenario where rain is not just, you know, unfortunate, it's a disaster. In the winter during the rainy season, you want your rain. In the summer, it's a disaster. So if we take the perspective about the Melech, that the evidence is mixed, and it could depend on how you're asking, why you're asking, what the Melech is going to look like, what your motivations are, you know, so then we could emerge with a view that this is the perfect response to that. Had it been the rainy season and you wanted a king, that would have been one thing. But the fact that it's the summer, right? Who's the leader of Klal Yisrael? Shmuel, who is the greatest leader we've had since Moshe Rabbeinu? We're winning wars. We're making peace treaties. There's tshuva. People are coming back on the, you know, they're going back to halachic observance. We're liberating cities in the Plishtim. It's never been better than it is now, right? And Shmuel is, you know, the best of the best. That is the moment when you want to abandon the model of the Shofet and bring in a Melech, right? Or, you know, you could have a Melech in one sense, you know, a Melech who you focus on security and uniting everybody. Instead, you just say you want one like all the rest of the nations. And, you know, you're taking what could be a bracha if done in the proper way, and you are turning it into a total klala. Right, so that's, I think, you know, a perspective that emerges. We see a whole range of Rishonim. I think one way to like kind of synthesize everything and come down into the next, you know, as we go forward, is this realization that, you know, a king is not inherently good, it's not inherently bad. It all can depend on the attitude of the people and of their time. Okay, so. Now we can move forward to the rest of what Shmuel says to them. So Shmuel now tells the people, right? And he says, here is the Mishpat HaMelech Asher Yimloch Alayhem. Here is what the king, you know, the law of the king, you know, when he rules over you. As a piece of rhetoric, you know, it is amazingly powerful what Shmuel does. You know, Shmuel is trying as hard as he can to get the people to, you know, turn away from this. So what does he do? And just a couple of pieces, right? So he's gonna tell them, you know, he's gonna conscript your sons into the army, and he's going to conscript your daughters into, you know, the kitchen staff in his palace, and he's going to tax you, and he'll take your land, and he'll take your produce, and he'll take your animals and your servants, you know. So a couple of themes that you have here. Number one, right, Mishpat HaMelech, right? So that's like so ironic, right? Here is the law of the king. The law of the king is he's going to take all your stuff, right? The law of the king, you know, the Mishpat, you're not getting the Mishpat of Shmuel, right? You're not getting the Mishpat of a Shofi. You're not getting someone who's sacrificing himself, traveling up and down the country to produce justice for the people. You're going to get the Mishpat HaMelech. And the Mishpat HaMelech is, you know, as Mel Brooks said, it's good to be the king, right? That's the Mishpat HaMelech that you are signing up for, right? So cynical. The way that Shmuel presents it is he hammers on the same themes over and over again. The Mishpat HaMelech is all about the king taking. Espenechem yikach. He's going to take your sons and he'll use it for his stuff, right? He'll take your daughters. He'll take your fields. Yikach, yikach, yikach. And then occasionally, he's going to give, right? Give, take, that's how it should work, right? You take and you give in response, right? We pay taxes to the government, and in return, we receive services. So that's okay. The king can take, but he's going to give. Well, says Shmuel, yeah, the king is going to give, but who is he going to give to? He's not going to give back to you. He's going to give to his cronies. Vinasan la'avadav. He'll take your land, and he'll give it. He'll give it to his cronies, right? His, you know, the courtiers in his court. He'll take your, he'll tax you, and he'll give the taxes to his sarisim, right, to his officers. So he's taking from you, and take, again and again and again, over and over. Shmuel just hammers it, right? B'nechem yikach, b'noseichem yikach, shidoseichem yikach, chamareichem yikach. He's going to give it to others. You know, so that's like one major piece that Shmuel does, just hammering it home. He also is trying, he's separating the king from the people, right? The king is not working for you. He's taking your stuff for himself. So for example, right, the most dramatic example of this is he says he's going to take your stuff for, you know, clay milchamto. He's going to take your stuff for, you know, for his weapons, for his wars, right? To do milchamto, mlachto, to do his labor, for his chariots. It's going to be all your stuff for him, right? This is not the king with the people. This is the king over the people, right? He is separate from you. He is taking your stuff. He's giving it to his cronies, and he's putting it to his own use, his own advantage. And Shmuel concludes, and he says, "You're going to cry out, right? Uzak ten bayom hahu, right? You're going to cry out because of your king." No, sorry. How does he conclude after saying everything? So Shmuel's conclusion of everything is, you know, summary: Atem tiyu lo la'avadim, right? You are going into slavery. That is what you are signing up for. So just bangs them again, right? Specific example, again and again and again: sons, daughters, fields, vineyards, land, animals, livestock, right? Conclusion: general statement. You are signing up to be avadim, and then you're going to cry out. And what does this remind us of? Well, a couple of things. Last time we were avadim was in Mitzrayim, right? You know, Hashem just told Shmuel, the Bnei Yisrael have been driving me nuts from Mitzrayim until now. Well, now you're going back into avdus. That's what you're signing up for. You're going back into slavery. You're going to cry out again, right? What happened last time they cried out? Right, we read it in last week's Parsha Shmos, right? Hashem heard our cry in Mitzrayim. Well, it's not going to happen now. Lo yana Hashem eschem bayom havu, right? You're going to cry out. Hashem is not going to answer. Now, you know, people are not impressed. Vayimanu am l'shma v'kol Hashem v'kol Shmuel, right? Earlier we had Hashem telling Shmuel listen to the voice of the people, but here the people don't. And what do they respond? They seem to reject Shmuel's fundamental argument, right? Because Shmuel had said, you know, the king is going to take your stuff to fight his wars. And we're trying to split the king from the people. Well, what do the people say back to Shmuel? So they say, no, we want a king. You know, we want to be like all the Goyim. You know, so they're doubling down. You know, imagine Shmuel's reaction. He's going to judge us. V'yatsa lefaneinu. He'll go out before us. V'nalcham es milchamoseinu. And he will fight our wars. They tell Shmuel, with all due respect, we disagree. We do not think the king will be set over us as a tyrant, you know, crushing the separated people. He's going to be our leader. He will go out in front of us, and he's going to fight our wars, right? So they reject the premise of Shmuel's argument, and they double down on wanting a melech kechol hagayim. Actually, one point that we should make, I meant to highlight, just to scroll up for a second. Remember, who was it who brought the request to Shmuel? It was the Rashi Ha'am, right? It was the leaders who came to Shmuel. When Shmuel responds, this is interesting and important, he does not answer, you know, the Nesiim who have come to him in Ramah. Shmuel makes sure to address, you know, his answer is going to go to the Am, right? He brings his response directly to the people. He doesn't bring it to the Nesiim, to the Rashi Ha'am to bring, you know, to convey to the people. If you are going to have a king, this a decision this momentous, Shmuel says, has to be brought directly to all of Klal Yisrael, right? And they are in conversation with him. At the end, it is the people who do not listen to Shmuel, right? This is not going to be, you know, the aristocrats are not going to decide what the government should be. If you want to create a melech, that is going to have to come from the people. They have to make the choice, and Shmuel is saying they are going to have to live with the choice. And just one more point about, you know, the message that Shmuel is getting across. So we saw already in the Medrash earlier, and in how Hashem presents the request for a king in Sefer Tvarim, this idea of the king as a avodah zar, right? You're basically putting your faith in kings instead of Hashem. You're worshiping your king for all intents and purposes. There could be another parallel here as well, right? Where we have this phenomenon of Shmuel telling Klal Yisrael, you're going to cry out, right? And Hashem's not going to answer you. So basically, what's Hashem saying, right? If you remember, this is exactly what Hosea said. Hosea said, you know, you're going to cry out. Well, go cry out to your king, right? You wanted a king to save you, says Hosea, looking back at this period of Shmuel, you know, turn to your king. Hashem's checking out, right? Hashem was your leader. Hashem was your Moshiach. You want a king? That's who you're stuck with. Well, that's exactly what Yirmiyahu says in the Haftorah that we read the week before Shabbos Chazon, right? Towards the end of the Haftorah, the second parak of Yirmiyahu. So Yirmiyahu says, right, Omrim la'etz aviata, right? You guys are worshiping stick and stone. So Yirmiyahu says, Ayelo hacha, sherasi sadach, right? Where are your gods? Yakumu u'yom shiyucha beis riyacha, right? Hashem is not going to respond. When you, as a consequence of you putting your faith in someone else to save you, when it's not working, you cannot then turn around and go back to Hashem. So what Shmuel is saying about the Melech and what Hosea really, really is saying about the Melech, you can connect it to Yirmiyahu and you have this running theme from Devarim, right, all the way through. The association with Bnei Yisrael putting their trust in a Melech, ultimately that is being looked at as a form of avodah zarah. Now, there's one very, you know, fundamental question about all these things that Shmuel is telling the people that's going to happen, which is a king actually allowed to do this or not, right? Is he allowed to take your sons and your daughters and your land and your livestock, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? So it's a debate in the Gemara, and it's really interesting to think about, because what is the actual answer? Gemara quotes Rav and Shmuel, right? The Amoraim who argue about the exact point. Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Kol Hamur Parshas Hamelach Malach Mutarbo. Shmuel says that the king is allowed to take everything that's described in the parak, right? He can take your sons, your daughters, your land, etc., etc., etc. Rav Amar Lo Nem Parshas Zo Ella LeAyim Aleihem. Rav says no. Shot in the Navi here is that Shmuel is not allowing the king to do this. Right, Shmuel is trying to scare the people. It's rhetoric to scare them straight. Maybe, you know, it's also like a realistic analysis of what is actually going to happen. Right. So that you have that machlokas Rav and Shmuel. If this was actually allowed, the exact same machlokas goes back to the Tanoim. The Gemara says it quotes a Braisa where Rabbi Yossi says it's permissible. Rabbi Yehuda says no. It was only a threat. What's so interesting is that both of those seem to be true, You know, on the one hand, it is clear that Shmuel was saying this le'ayim aleihem, right, to intimidate Bnei Yisrael, right? Yikach, yikach, yikach. He's going to take. He's going to take. He's going to take. The whole argument was set up to terrify Klal Yisrael. On the other hand, you know, even if we think in terms of the first three kings who Klal Yisrael are going to have, well, we'll see Shaul in a few prakim, who is talking to these newly minted aristocrats from his tribe of Shevet Binyamin, and Shaul is talking about, you know, the lands and the vineyards that they have, and that, you know, David might take away and give to someone else. So it's clear from there that indeed the king has the authority to transfer title to all sorts of lands. David's sons are going to have, you know, Jewish men running in front of their chariots. And we're going to have Shlomo, who's going to be placing massive taxes on the people, right? So almost all of the examples that Shmuel presents to Klal Yisrael as what life will look like with the king, we actually are going to see them in action, even in the first three kings who Klal Yisrael are going to have. And at the same time, there's no question that when Shmuel presents this to the people, it is the Ayim Aleihem. So it's a fascinating example of Machlokes in the Gemara, how to understand what's going on here in the Navi. But the answer really is that both views are correct. For a little long time, so we'll skip. In the Monday night a couple weeks ago, we talked to this fascinating question that Tosfos here asked, which is, if a king indeed is allowed to take all of this land, so why did Achav get in so much trouble for killing Naboth, since he should have just taken his vineyard? So, you know, Tosfos have a number of answers to the question. I think the one that the Rambam endorses is that, you know, it's not so simple for a king to just take whatever he wants. He has to be acting in the national interest. That's what the Rambam suggests. So you can give things to the Rambam as well. You can give things to his servants. You know, if it's a matter of setting up a functioning, you know, monarchical system, which means you have to be able to have, you know, lords and aristocrats who are going to work for you. So that's one thing, but just taking it totally for yourself is something else. Not a lot of comfort for the people, and so Shmuel's telling him, you know, on your end, not going to be so helpful. But, you know, things are just a little more complicated than they seem. We should just be aware of that. To close, because the end of the parak is absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. After all this, and the chutzpah that Bnei Yisrael have when they answer to Shmuel by doubling down and saying, we want a king like all of the Goyim, right? Like all the other nations. And we're just unimpressed with your claim that he's going to be over us and apart from us. No, he's going to be at our head. What does Shmuel do? Vayishma Shmuel is called Direi Ha'am by the Rein Baznei Hashem. Shmuel hears what the people say, and he reports it to Hashem. So Shmuel listens to what the people say, and he brings it back to God. Now, you know, you could wonder, why does Shmuel have to do this? You know, Hashem is well aware of what the people said to Shmuel. It's like Shmuel has to turn around to Hashem and say, you know, here's what's happening, here's what the people told me. Hashem's aware. But the truth is, that is the quintessential function of a Navi. A Navi is not just supposed to present Hashem's word to people. The Navi is supposed to be the conduit between Hashem and Bnei Yisrael. The Navi is supposed to be a two-way conduit. And what's amazing is that the most classic example of this behavior is Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai. And we think about this because it might communicate a lot. What happens, right? That momentous moment, right? Whatever Hashem says, we're going to do. And Moshe brings the words back to Hashem. One pasuk later, Hashem tells Moshe the game plan. Once again, so let's think about that for a second. Number one, we have yet another parallel between the behavior of Moshe Rabbeinu as a Navi and Shmuel as a Navi, right? That not only do they confer with Hashem to figure out what to do and then present that to the entire nation, but they also then take what the nation says and bring it back to Hashem. Shmuel is in the Moshe Rabbeinu Navi playbook once again. And at the same time, how different is the situation back in Shmos? Right, the last time we saw the Navi presenting what the people are saying to Hashem, and what we have here, Moshe who's telling, right, who's presenting to Hashem, the people, right, Nasa v'Nishma, right. I talk to Klal Yisrael, and they accept Hashem's Malchus. And what's happening here? The exact opposite, right? Shmuel turns to Hashem and says, I laid out everything. I gave it my best shot. They want a king, right? They want a Melech Basar Vedam to replace the Melech Elyon. So similar to Moshe Rabbeinu, and it highlights the gap in the circumstances that they face. And yet, despite all of that, right, despite the personal rejection, despite the failure, Shmuel goes along with it, right? And he's going to throw himself 100% into the project of monarchy once that's where things are going to go. Even though he thinks it's wrong, he knows it's wrong, Hashem says that's what they want, that's what we're going to give them, he's going to be in it 100%. He's going to be davening for Shaul the whole way through. We saw in, you know, those key psukim in Tehillim, right, which connected Shmuel to Moshe and Aaron, Moshe ran Mechana v'Shmuel b'Karei Shema. So we can appreciate a little bit more now that, and you know, what happens a couple of psukim later in that parah, where Tehillim said, Hashem Elokeinu atani sam, ke'on lo se'ayiso lahan, you answered them, v'nokim al alilo sam, and you took vengeance for what happened, the misdeeds that happened to them. Mepharshim say, that's referring to Korach from Moshe and Aaron. When there was a rebellion against the authority of Moshe and Aaron, Hashem stepped in, right? Hashem bailed them out. They remained at the lead, at the head, and that's what Hashem did after the Korach rebellion. Well, here Mefarshim say Hashem's going to step in for Shmuel also because he's going to give Shmuel a thunderstorm in Perek Yud Beis, and that's the revenge that Shmuel's going to get. That's very nice, but at the same time, right? Shmuel faces his own Korach rebellion here. And this time Hashem says the people are going to get what they want, right? Shmuel is not going to be the leader. And yet, despite that Shmuel takes it, right? He didn't deserve it, but he takes it. It's what Hashem wants for the people. We're going to accept it. We're going to move on. And his whole legacy after this is going to be throwing himself in for Shaul and for David, right? Because Shmuel just is the example par excellence of what it means to lead Klal Yisrael. He's not in it for himself whatsoever. He's all in it for the people and the will of Hashem. If that's what we're going to do, then that's what we're going to do. Despite the fact that he's done everything like Moshe Rabbeinu, and he's being given the exact opposite result. Is what it is, we're going to move forward. And last point to close is that where is Shmuel getting the model for this behavior from? Well, ultimately, he's getting it from Hashem himself, right? There's this cool book that's been published by Moshe Halbertal, The Beginning of Politics, published by Princeton University Press. I disagree with a lot of it. Part of the problem when you have some of these books, which are seriously treating Sefer Tanakh, but also from like a secular political perspective. But it's a very sensitive read. And they make the point here that you can't read the Psukim of Shmuel without getting the smell of Avodah Zarah. The association of a king and Avodah Zarah, you can't miss it. It's right there. We saw it. They just point out what needs to be pointed out. That, you know, you see idolatry here. We would expect Hashem to respond harshly. You kind of suspect that's what Shmuel was hoping for, right? And yet, what are they, right? God, in a startling act of self-limitation, abdicated his monopoly on the throne, right? Hashem says, look, that's what the people feel they need right now. You know, the project of the Shoftim has not worked out in the aggregate. It's wonderful with Shmuel at the head, right? But we look back at the end of Shoftim, Ein Melech b'Yisrael, Ishe Yashar b'Enav Yaseh, the Sefer Achinuch's point that as bad as a bad king is, it's better than nothing. And so Hashem says, I'm going to step back and I'm going to renounce my right to rule the people. You know, we could think of a Melech Basar Vedam as a Avodah Zarah, and nonetheless, Hashem is going to go along with it. And so that, right, Hashem's behavior here provides the exact model for Shmuel as well. You know, if Hashem is not too big, Chas v'Shalom, to adjust course because of where Klal Yisrael are and where they need to go going forward, so Shmuel is not going to be, right? At the end of the day, it's not about what Shmuel himself wants personally. It's not about what Shmuel himself feels is right or wrong. It's what Hashem thinks is appropriate in the current time. And Hashem is going to take the hit for himself, and he says, this is how we're going to move going forward. So Shmuel will go along with it, and he's going to go along 100%. So that's, you know, when we come out from this whole analysis. Could be good, could be bad. But, you know, bottom line is that Hashem decides the people do indeed need one, for better or for worse. We're going to go along with it. And it's a tough moment for Shmuel, who's losing his leadership. It's a tough moment for Baruch Shalom, who's losing his leadership. But that's the move we're going to make. And then we're going to make the most of it. That's going to happen going forward. So next week, we'll introduce Shaul next week. And so that'll be very exciting. And it's Hashem, you know, so thanks everyone for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Goldstein.